Okay, we might get started. Welcome. Thank you everyone for coming to this talk. Welcome to Sydney Chamber Opera. I know a lot of you have been coming for a long time. Welcome to Carriage Works. I'm Vanessa Hughes. This is Jack Simons, who you may know, Artistic Director of Sydney Chamber Opera and composer of one of the works tonight, pianist of everything tonight. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional lands on which we meet. I grew up in Ngunnawal country. I live on Wangal country and we meet tonight on Gadigal land. And on none of these places has sovereignty been ceded. I acknowledge the damage done, continuing to be done by colonisation. And I pay my respects to all First Nations people with us tonight and elders past and present. Tonight we are watching three operas, or maybe they should be called monodramas. We might get into that a bit later. You're going to be hearing four snapshots of this monodrama by this Finnish composer, the late, great Kaija Saariaho. And I'm going to be asking Jack why on earth she is such a darling of contemporary classical composers and lovers of that music. Why is she the real deal? You're going to be hearing a phone call that goes for about 40 minutes by Francis Poulenc. And then you're going to be hearing, well, a bite-sized interpretation of one of the most epic and some might say difficult to read pieces of Australian literature by this composer here, Jack Simons. So let's start with you, Jack, and Voss. You take this book by Patrick White. It is based on a true story of an explorer, Leichhardt, who vanished in the middle of the outback way back when. The book, as you told me, once upon a time, Patrick White used to go to local libraries and pull it out of the shelves just to see what the last page was that was bookmarked, to see where people actually gave up. And that, in fact, many people probably claimed to finish Voss but didn't. So it's already been turned into an opera by Richard Meal. Tell us about the differences between that work and where you tried to take it when you wrote it a few years ago.
Well, pretty much everything is different. So there's not one thing in common between Richard's, in many ways, very beautiful kind of romantic opera that, to an extraordinarily precise and beautifully written libretto by David Malouf, who turned Patrick White's Voss into a highly poetic, very evocative and extremely operatic text. What that opera does, though, is it in many ways takes all of the ideas of grand opera and grafts them onto this great novel, and it can sustain it. I think it's a great piece, but it's not the only interpretation possible with a work like that. I mean, what I love about Voss, the novel, I suppose, is the central character. For me, it's a novel that lots of the other parts of it perhaps haven't aged so well, perhaps speak to a different time, the time it was written, and also the time in which it's set in the 19th century. But for me, the idea of a lone individual that fuses themselves to the natural world in a kind of self-immolation is a wonderful provocation for a monodrama. And so that's what I sort of set out as the fundamental point about this Voss. And it was very much a collaboration with both the singer for whom I was always going to write it, Mitchell Riley, and also the writer, Piers Wilcox, who wrote the text for this. And my instructions to Piers in how on earth to adapt this vast, sprawling thing was that I wanted a series of very, very short poems, and they couldn't be more than four lines long. And so in doing something like that, it has to be completely remade. I mean, none of this actual text is taken from Patrick White in a way, because it's impossible to just fit these enormous epic sentences and paragraphs and just shave them down to less than 1% of their original length. However, for those of you, there are lots of little Easter eggs. For those of you who know and love the novel, who knows how many there are, and listening on the recording when we record this, for those of you listening at home, if you know the novel very well, you'll find lots of points of contact. In every one of these 21 short songs, there is a major point of contact and almost a summary of this vault. But I imagined it highly condensed and fragmented so that we see the evolution of a character who starts out in a way farewelling the world that he knows and ends up face down in the dirt, having been killed by the natural world around him. And in between, a lot of varied things happen, and you have to see what happens on stage to find out.
But you didn't just pick those bits. As you say, it was a collaboration between you and Pierce and Mitchell. So did you all just chip in bits from the book that you liked? Did you all read the book to begin with? Test that? And how did you choose which bits to put in?
We were all great fans of the book, but what we decided we would do, we would all write down quotes and lines from the bits that we liked and see which were the overlapping bits, see which were the bits that spoke to all of us together. And then Pierce sort of like synthesized all that, and a couple of months later these 21 short poems came out, and it was kind of, it represented the culmination of the long process of filleting and selecting and making things that are close to our hearts.
That's a lot of trust, I think, that you have in the people you're working with to also make good creative choices with the text. I mean, Pierce isn't creating it in a vacuum, just reading it himself. So how does that work with that trust? I mean, do you get together with these final 21 little miniature poems, no longer than four lines each, and agree with which parts of the book they represent and how to direct them on stage?
Well, to me it was very clear, and to Mitchell as well, which parts were which parts of which book, which parts of the book they were. And I guess the director, Alex Bellage, didn't come to this show with an overwhelming love of Voss and sort of had to learn it on the fly, and has taken the fragmentary nature of the poetry and the playfulness that sometimes comes from reducing these enormous epic ideas into tiny little epigrams, and has really leaned into Mitchell Raleigh's incredible ability as a physical theatre performer. He lives in France and has trained at clown school in, well, I should say that, at Jacques Lecoq, which is like
the... Yeah, we call it clown school, but it's serious business.
But it's serious physical theatre business. And so knowing that he had this ability to sort of shape his body into almost anything and convey that meant that it gave the director a lot of leeway to play between text and music and performer, which I guess is, for me, the interesting space in this art form when... a performer creative team and work can bring overlapping but separate skill bases to make a total artwork.
You've been working with Mitchell Raleigh for so long, long before he went off to clown school and moved to Paris, and writing for him. When you come together again now, all those years later, is it the same working together? How much has the creative partnership changed?
Well, I write much more extremely for him than for almost anybody else. I mean, the first pieces I wrote for him, I guess, resemble baritone writing. But as you'll hear tonight, this goes far beyond that. It's sort of, it's a range of three or more than three octaves. He has an amazing ability to sing incredibly high in falsetto and very for a very sustained period of time and have a lot of colour variety in that, as well as being unafraid to explore the real sepulchral, almost gravelly depths of something out of the sung, the normal sung accepted colour, and writing for that enormous spectrum. Sometimes it's a bit unhinged, but you can make up your own mind for that. But it's certainly the extremity of what I've made for him now versus what I first wrote for him in 2011 has been the product of a long and fruitful working relationship.
And the extremes become more extreme with the presence of Ben Carey, working with live electronics on your piano, electronics on the voice. So what else is happening to Mitchell's voice?
Well, I think electronics for me are most interesting when they extend the natural sound of what's actually happening live, or else you'd be listening to, you know, a soundtrack, or you'd be at home just fiddling around with your own synthesizer, as it were. But what Ben's able to do very interestingly, is sometimes take what happens live in the show, what happens live in the performance, and transform that with his magical computer programs, which I have no idea how they work. I just say what I want it to sound like, and it sounds like that. So thank you, Ben. he's able to transform the music into ways that I find most interesting when it takes the instrument or the voice to a place that it couldn't be before. For instance, the piano has 88 keys, and for lots of people that's enough, but when you play the piano enough, you start to wonder what's on the other side of there and all the way down there. And so with electronics, you can, of course, take the piano to infinite highs and infinite lows. Likewise with the voice, and likewise you can make what's called a synthesis of the two. You can take the sound of the voice and the sound of the piano and fuse them into what it might be to imagine these as a single sound and a blend that's impossible to achieve live. So I find that an interesting space to work in. For the reason of this piece being that so much of it is about imagining a space vaster than oneself, creating a place for the performer, myself included as the pianist in it, to go that's bigger than just two people on stage, a vastness and a kind of epic impossibility is how I'd characterise these electronics. And that's what we've tried to achieve with this piece. And it's certainly some of the detail of what I've asked for in the score. So, you know, if I scrape a piano string with my fingernail, it can turn into a vast maelstrom of sound very, very easily, which is a very, very soft, gentle sound on the instrument normally, for instance, in a very simple example.
Are you telling Ben, make this scarier, make it hotter, or make it higher?
All of the above.
Your relationship with the piano, as you were talking about, and the way that we're going to hear you and see you play it, can be pretty out of this world for this particular piece, for all the reasons you've indicated. What about the pieces that you treasure from the 19th century and the way the piano was used there and how much you hold that at the centre of what you're doing there and where you want to take it? Talk to me about that.
Yeah, well, I think at the heart of it, you know, Voss is a 19th century character. And so at the heart of the content of the composition, I was very interested in rooting a lot of it in the fundamental ideas from some of my favourite pieces from the 19th century, I Love on the Piano. And having the idea that this kind of frayed romanticism, which is actually so present in Patrick White's writing as well, is a continuing line right from the 19th century until now. So for those of you who really love piano music, you will maybe hear, if you really listen carefully, quite heavily transformed echoes of some things that I love. For instance, Papillon of Schumann, which is one of my very favourite miniatures, and this is a piece of miniatures as well, and a very, very late Nocturne by Fauré, which I make a paraphrase of much later in the piece, which, you know, perhaps if I were to choose one single piano work to say from a fire, it might be the one, actually, the 13th Nocturne of Fauré. And as well, you'll hear bits of Liszt and a few other little surprises for those who love piano music, but it's really taking the fundamental content of these pieces and what they represent in romanticism to me, rather than a kind of catalogue of things that I like, although perhaps composition is always just a catalogue of things one likes.
Look, just to wrap up about The Shape of the Earth, your monodrama that we're kicking off with tonight, it's a man who ultimately starves to death or dies, you know, not well, in the middle of the outback. What do you want us to feel other than bleak?
I mean, I suppose the composer is often the wrong person to ask about what you want to feel from it, but I suppose a sense that there is, I think what I was talking about before, I think that there is a line between, the fine line between infinite sort of romantic ambition and the failure of the human body is something which we all face at one time or another.
Yeah, bright. Let's talk about Poulenc. After Interval, Le Voix Humaine, a 40-minute phone call that you only hear one side of. And we can only imagine what on earth is being said on the other end of the phone. You've got Celeste Lazarenko singing with the phone, which you will see. I won't give anything away about that monodrama. What is so special to you about this particular work by Poulenc? You've talked in the past about his brevity with melody. So how does that come into this one?
Well, for me, Poulenc, this piece is like the ultimate Poulenc. I'm a huge fan of this composer. He was a French composer who lived in the first half of the 20th century, Parisian in every sense of the word, musically, in terms of his character, and in terms of the history that he imbibed and the subjects he took on. And what I love about his music is that he really did one thing his whole life, and did that one thing to an extraordinary perfection, which is write teeny tiny little phrases all in 2 bars long, over and over again. And it's an amazing, in a way, it's a miniaturizing process, such as I also have in my own piece, like the idea that you condense all of these ideas into these tiny miniatures, and he's able to say a whole world with just 2 bars and then move on to a completely different 2 bars. And how it hangs together is purely on the force of his personality. There's no analyzable way that this music makes sense together. It is purely charisma and uniqueness, I suppose, as a composer. And this piece in particular is a 40-minute long sequence of teeny tiny little phrases, which might sound like the most unappealing thing you can possibly imagine. However, the text by Jean Cocteau is itself completely fragmentary, as we're only hearing one side of the conversation of a woman who's undergoing the end of a relationship and pleading and thinking and reminiscing with her former lover on the phone about what this relationship was and if there's any future. And that suits Poulenc just fine, because the second we hear one of her answers, the other side interrupts, often represented by the music and by the piano, and he's able to pivot with an extraordinary precision through this enormous kaleidoscope of emotions by using this technique. It's a very late work, written in the last 5 years of his life, and it's like, for me, his whole life's work was sort of leading up to this point. This was a work he had to write. It's his third opera, very experienced in the medium, and it's a totally unique piece, but I just adore the way that he's able to create a sense of 40 minutes of immediacies. There's very little past, there's very little future, it's all present.
She comes across as obviously desperate, heartbroken, beside herself, and sometimes you might say manipulative. So what do you think about Poulenc's painting of her character as a woman in that situation?
I think as a great songwriter and a great opera composer, he was incredibly compassionate and sympathetic at instantly having an audience and a listener identify with the principal emotion of the song. In a Poulenc song, for instance, he was a wonderful accompanist, absolutely one of the great song accompanists of the mid-century. And in a Poulenc song, in the first bar, you instantly identify, you know who the singer is, you know who this person is, you understand exactly what emotion is happening. And so he's able to not just have a woman that's purely desperate or searching for absolution in the end of this relationship. He's able to create a very, very fully rounded character very quickly. And so it gives us, I find, as a performer and as a listener before I perform this piece, he gives us an amazingly well-rounded portrait very, very quickly.
You sit down with Clements Williams to direct. Do you three have an idea about who's on the other end and what on earth they're saying?
I mean, yes, it's certainly the director's job is to make sure that the performer understands the total idea of how all the music interacts, how what's on the other end of the line. And I have my own ideas, and I've said them occasionally, sometimes in rehearsal, what I think I'm playing on the piano. What I think is happening. I mean, there's lots that needs to be left up to both the performer, left up to the audience. There's a wonderful ambiguity And the music that the piano has in between, the piano accompanies most of the time, but there's lots of moments of sudden interruption where we really understand that there's something else being said on the other end of the line. And Poulenc's given us a wonderful array of different options. So everyone's going to bring their own sensibilities and their own interpretation to listening to a piece like this on the piano.
But what is going on? Can you tell me?
I think everyone has to find out for themselves. I think, you know, I'm not going to say you have to, like, hopefully the production will make that clear. That's up to the performer and the director to do that.
With Celeste's performance, what should we be looking out for about how she inhabits this role? It's been performed by, you know, so many, Jesse Norman, Barbara Hannigan. What are we looking out for with Celeste's performance?
I think Celeste brings a real vulnerability to this role. I mean, and a lyricism to the part that one of the things about doing it in the piano and voice version is that you can do a lot, the voice can inhabit a lot more range of intimacy than when you do it with an enormous orchestra. They are the options of this piece. The piece was only performed with full orchestra until the 2010s when Poulenc's estate gave permission for it to be done in his original version for piano. He played it as a pianist with the original soprano Denise Duval a lot, but I feel, and then he thereafter he forbade performances of the piano version when he wouldn't play it, and I feel that's something that's very characteristic of him. He couldn't bear another pianist to be touching this piece. So, sorry, Poulenc.
It's paired in the second half with Sarriaho's monodrama quatre instants. It's a pretty deliberate choice, I suspect, to put Sarriaho after the Poulenc.
Yeah, I think this piece treads the same thematic territory as the Poulenc, in that a woman has ended a relationship and we are reliving this through her. But in some senses, the Poulenc is quite a male gaze kind of work. You know, it's as wonderful as it is, it's very much at its heart, there could be, you know, you could understand that this is simply a hysterical woman written by two men. Which, you know, I think in this day and age, I didn't want to just end the night with that. And I think by having an answer by truly one of history's greatest female composers, one of the greatest composers, regardless of gender, but having an answer to this that treads the same territory but from a completely different perspective. This perspective is one that grants the protagonist a lot of agency, a lot of power, and a huge amount of sensuality, of reliving the emotions of a past relationship with an enormous physical pleasure that in a way is quite absent in the Poulenc, quite deliberately absent in the Poulenc. She's denied that so often that it's like it floods in this Sarriaho song cycle that we're staging for the first time in the world.
And it's not the first time you've staged Sarriaho, so you did the Passion of Simone. Mm-hmm. Why is she the real deal? I mean, in my experience, I find like the Bach people are really intense. I mean, he's great, don't get me wrong, but the Bach people are intense about Bach. The late Beethoven string quartet people are intense about the late string quartets of Beethoven. And the Sarriaho people are like, I will die on this hill for Sarriaho. What is it about her that is so genius?
We're nothing compared to the Wagnerians.
Oh, quite right.
But no, I think her music, when you're receptive to it, inhabits you in a physical way, much as so that other composers, that her music creates an entire world. She was able in her life, and she passed away at age 70, at the peak of her powers in June this year, and from a very aggressive form of cancer. And her music creates an entire world around you. It's like you're able to live in it. And I find that so much of the greatest music, that when you have these sort of fanatics, it's often because it gives you a complete, for certain people for whom it hits you, it gives you a complete world to feel as if it's really real nerve endings, real flesh, real breath inside this musical body. And that's very rare among composers. And for me, it's very much like that. I mean, I've performed a lot of her music now, including, yes, that big opera, La Passion of Simone, in the beginning of 2019. And I just adore the sensation of performing it and listening to it. I've heard a lot of it, but in performing it, this piece on the piano, it's actually her first work for the piano. It's written in 2002 after her second opera, just as a study for her second opera, rather. But she hadn't written for the piano, which is extraordinary for one of the most common instruments to write for and for a major, major, major composer, for the reason being that the kind of natural state of Sarriaho's music is as a kind of pulsing, constantly vibrating tone, sliding from one to the next, breaking, turning from pure tone into noise and back again in a total continuum. All the things a piano cannot do. You can't glissando from one note to the next in the piano. There's a hard barrier between the keys. There are only 88 pitches, which might seem a lot to some people, but not to Kaija Sarriaho. And the idea of a continuum from kind of white noise to the purest sound is also likewise impossible. So what she's done is turn this instrument into a pulverizing ocean of sound that almost defies the instrument's capabilities.
All right. Is it the hardest thing you've played?
It's certainly up there, simply because it's often written with the idea that you might have three or more hands. In that she wants all the registers of the piano, all the parts of the piano to be sounding simultaneously. So, you know, with these just mortal two hands, we can't really often meet everything that she's asking for, but the idea that you have to activate the top and the middle and the bass in different ways almost all the way through the piece means that I do look like a kind of manic octopus if the lighting state were bright enough to see what I'm actually doing.
And there are some really steamy moments in this, some super erotic bits where you're playing a lot and she's singing a lot. How is that interaction on stage in terms of how much are you giving in those moments to the music and how much is written down?
Well, Emily Edmonds is a wonderful singer, and she's the performer tonight, who I've played quite a bit of recent contemporary music with, and she's a very passionate performer and one who loves living in a kind of world. Rehearsing with her, most of the things we talk about is like what's the world that we're creating together and what's the total relationship between voice and piano and what's the colour we want to achieve as a whole. And this is so rewarded in the piece like this Sarriaho, when on stage she's often making either this merest sliver of sound or a pretty enormous tsunami of tone, and matching that and finding the points of continuum along that is really the great pleasure of rehearsing and performing this piece.
Is it hard when the piece is so demanding technically for you to be that present, especially in terms of overpowering or getting in the way and making noise around what Emily's singing?
I think that's the pleasure. You know, if it were a piece that was easy to play, I might be not as engaged in a way. I mean, I might be sort of, my mind might be wandering for a second. Who knows what I might be thinking about? But like when at every moment I'm thinking about how are my 10 fingers interacting with her voice, it's a wonderful feeling of presence. And when one knows the piece, as I hope to be able to demonstrate tonight, we'll see. When one knows the piece well, technically, it becomes like doing a very pleasurable muscle memory task, such as anyone might have, such as swimming or something.
This one is also directed by Clements Williams. Mm-hmm. What was Clements asking you to do with the work?
Well, she said, why am I directing this first? But also, there's also the idea that why create a visual representation of a piece that wasn't intended to be staged. And we've done that a lot at SEO. It's a very, on-brand thing for us to do, is to take works that have implicit monodrama potential and represent that through visual metaphor, and also bring a new audience to it as well. I mean, there are people who, where else would you hear this piece? You hear this piece in a vocal recital, and it might be 20 minutes to the really end of the first half or something, so it doesn't often get the same weight that I think this absolute masterpiece of voice and piano writing deserves. And so to elevate it to a staging, for me, creates a wonderful dialogue between what does it mean to represent something visually and find visual metaphors for things that actually happen in the music. So talking with the director, you often talk about how does the music work, and sometimes how the music works becomes a very present and potent metaphor on stage, and there's a couple of those tonight you'll have to find out.
I believe this is your 10th anniversary of performing with Emily.
Mm-hmm.
She has done Berlin, she's done Covent Garden, she broadcasted ABC Classic. Is it different now coming together? What's it like for you two working together after so much has happened for you professionally, both of you?
Oh, it's just the same. I mean, you pick up where you left off with so many people when you work together, especially when you're young and you're both finding out what you love, you just pick up where you've left off. And after not having performed with her for probably 5 or more years, it was just like we came off the stage yesterday. So it's lovely in that way.
In a nutshell, what's happening in these 4 chapters?
Yeah, in this aria host. So in our first song is a kind of, it's called Longing, and it's a kind of the idea of what it means to almost physically leave the body longing for love. And it's in these huge arcs of sound that go across instrument and voice that seem to kind of defy the laws of musical gravity in keeping them afloat. And the metaphor of a boat on the water is often invoked, and that's what she's made. The second song is called Pain, and this goes through both the intersection of pain and pleasure, and how that works in a relationship and in love, indeed.
The message seems to be, to me, at that point in it, that she doesn't want to give in to this lover, but as she says, my body is betraying me, and she can't help herself. So there's a lot of self-loathing in there.
Sure. I mean, and we'll see how that represents. There's a very, there's certainly a metaphor for that on the stage. and it's this is music. This is, Sarajevo has an amazing sense of kind of what I'd call ecstatic violence. She's able to create a hugely powerful, pulverizing force in music, but with a kind of sensual precision. Unlike anything I know, I don't know any other composer that manages that. That's one of, if I could say her, like the one thing she does that nobody else does, it's that. It's that kind of pulverizing, erotic, sensual, violent ecstasy that is unique. But she also has, in the third movement, called the perfume of the instant, the perfume of the moment. She also has a way of creating something that's essentially almost a lyrical art song in a way. This is a very, very, this is imagining the smells of memory of a lover. And the voice sings very, very lyrical phrases, while the piano often washes up and down, using the instrument like a huge continuum of tone. In the introduction to the score, Sarajevo says the pianist is allowed to wear fingerless gloves because there's so much gliding with the back of the hands, and I have destroyed the back of my fingers. I'm not going to wear fingerless gloves for it.
Why
I've got a callus now.
They can be quite chic.
Well, it certainly inhibits lots of the rest of the motion of the piece if you do such a thing. So there's a lot of that kind of motion. And the fourth song is what makes, for me, is what makes elevates this song cycle to the really, to extraordinary work of genius for me, which is the whole fourth song called Resonances is made up of all the bits of the first three songs threaded together in a totally new way, as if to demonstrate the idea that at a great distance of memory, all of these different sensations of longing, of pain, of pleasure, they all become mixed in one's mind into a totally different order of sensations and emotions. And there's not a single note in this fourth song that I haven't played somewhere else in the song cycle, but it's totally reordered. And for us to do it as well, it's like it's sort of your muscles want to do the other bit, but actually it has to be this slightly new way of interpreting the song. But it's a wonderful and very, very visceral poetic evocation of what it means to remember something from a great distance.
If you can sort of thread these three works together and how they feel together, What are we taking away?
Well, I think they're all works about loss. They're all works about absence, but they deal with it in completely different ways. Certainly, in the first work, in my piece, it's very much about the loss of the self in the enormity of the world. In the Poulenc, it's very, very directly about the loss of a relationship that won't come back, and a kind of very first person desperation about that. In the Sarajevo, it's tread some of the same ground, but from a place of much greater power and much greater arc of memory.
Thanks, Jack.
Thanks, Vanessa.
Enjoy the show, everyone.
Enjoy the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming.